we go. Baby, now I got the flow. Cause I know it from the start. Baby, when you broke my heart, that I had to come again and show you that I'd win.
Good morning, everyone. It is Monday, December 11th, 2017, and the Green Bay Packers still have life. They pulled off another overtime victory for the second consecutive week, this time coming back from a two-touchdown deficit to knock off the winless Cleveland Browns. Final score 27-21 on another walk-off touchdown, this one from wide receiver Devontae Adams. And here to discuss all of that with me and all the madness that happened up until that touchdown is Tom Silverstein, fellow beat reporter at the Journal Sentinel. And Tom, was it as wild and crazy to you as it seemed to me from my couch in Green Bay?
Yeah, the last 10 minutes of it were, that's for sure. Up until then, it was like pulling teeth to watch two teams like that go at it. Although I gotta say, Cleveland played a lot better and is a lot better team than their record. I know that's a cliche, but they do have a nice, I think they've got their a nice structure set up, and if they can get some high level draft picks, which they have, and now they have John Dorsey to pick it, I think they could be in decent shape in that. Maybe even by next year.
Yeah, and I think the whole tide of the AFC North is going to change whenever Roethlisberger decides to hang it up, and that's obviously closer to now than it is farther away from the present time. So you never know. In a couple of years, they could be a decent team there. Okay, so let's start with overtime. I think I asked you this exact same question last week, and when overtime started, what was going through your mind based on the way the game played out when you realized that Cleveland had won the toss?
Well, I wasn't sure what I didn't think it was as sure a thing as I thought it would have been if Tampa Bay had gotten the ball in overtime, because Cleveland had stubbed its toe a couple of times in the fourth quarter, and so I wasn't feeling like it was automatic, but I did think they would score. I was somewhat surprised that they didn't. You know, they seemed to be ready to move the ball. I got a first down. And it was just going to be a matter of who was going to make the big mistake first, whether it be the Packers or whether it would be Cleveland. And as we saw, it wound up being Cleveland.
So the play that you know, everyone in Cleveland will dread if they end up going winless this season, and one that could end up propelling the Packers into the playoffs, was made by two guys really in particular. You know, first, Clay Matthews was the one that got a hand on DeShone Kizer on a third down pass, and it forced this, what was already going to be an ill-advised throw anyway, into a fluttering lollipop into the middle of the field, and Josh Jones leapt into the air, caught it, and gave the Packers terrific field position, and then they drove down and won the game. And then the second player is one that you wrote about, so why don't you talk about the importance of Demarius Randall on that play and the game in general?
Yeah, so Randall was matched up against Josh Gordon. Anytime they were in man-to-man coverage, which they did anytime Gordon wasn't in the slot, I'll have to go back and look at that play, because I'm not sure if he was in the slot or if he was just wide to that side. But he was definitely in slot depth. You know, he wasn't far wide out, you know, to the wide side towards the sideline. And Randall, with it being third and two, had to play the slant. And he got up in Gordon's face and he grabbed him and bumped him and did everything you can do within 5 yards, and probably could have gotten called for a penalty with his arms around him. But by that time, Kizer had kind of retreated and had decided that wasn't the throw he wanted to make. So just the fact that he had been there bumping him and disrupting his rhythm caused Kizer to go to his next read. And that, by that time, Clay Matthews was making progress to him, and we all know what happened after that.
Yeah, and clearly it's a mistake made by a rookie quarterback, because either to the same side of the field where Gordon was or when he retreated, Kizer certainly had the option to roll one way or the other, throw the ball out of bounds, and then they punt it away and trust their defense. And so he didn't have to make that crazy throw down the middle of the field that Jones picked off. But again, you know, the Packers needed something, and Matthew stepped up, and I think that's a tougher catch by Jones than a lot of people might think, because there was, you know, six or seven people around it all jumping at the same time. And so to maintain possession all the way to the ground, I thought was impressive. But the Randall thing to me is so fascinating, not only because of the context of the season in general, which you wrote about in today's paper, but also just the idea that the one thing that you and I discussed on the podcast leading into the game about how it's going to be a long afternoon if he has to try and play physical with him. Well, he needed to do it one time, and it worked for him. You know, it's just crazy how those things work out sometimes.
Yeah, one thing I'll say about him is that he doesn't have to play just one way. He's not one of these guys who necessarily has to be physical or has to be off or, you know, has to do his press without his hands. He's pretty multifaceted from that standpoint, and he's pretty strong. You know, he played safety in college, and he, you know, everybody knew he had talent. What the problem was between his ears, and I think some of that is taking care of itself through maturity and maybe from, you know, getting to the rock bottom and then coming back. We'll see if he continues. You know, the big thing they have to do is make sure all this doesn't go to his head. But right now he's the best corner that they have. He's practically the only corner that they have now, because Devon House messed up his shoulder or got kicked in the back, I think. And I don't know what his status will be next week. So they're really paper thin there, but they at least have a guy they can count on to cover the other team's best receiver.
Yeah, you know, I was just scrolling through Twitter late last night, and Devon House posted this sort of weird cryptic tweet that I'll read now. It was several hours after they got back to Green Bay, the team, you know, on the team plane, and he said, "I will be okay. Thank you all who prayed for me today. Want to thank God for this adversity that I will be going through. Something great is going to come out of this," which I thought was kind of bizarre, because if it wasn't anything even semi-serious, I don't know why you go through all the hassle of saying there's all this adversity that you're dealing with. I don't know. To me, it just sort of seemed like maybe there is something wrong there.
Yeah, and I don't know how to read through guys' posts on Twitter.
Was House in the locker room after the game at all?
No, I did not see him. I think he took a pretty good shot to the kidney, is my guess. It looked to me like Gordon kicked him right in the kidney, and, you know, maybe he just had, you know, that's got to be really painful. And it could just be a pain issue. It could be, you know, contusion. You know, maybe they check for a lacerated kidney or something like that. But who knows? I didn't expect him to play. He was doubtful on Friday.
Agreed.
And Packers will probably hear from the league about that, because doubtful guys are very rarely supposed to play.
So what about the secondary in general? This was the second straight week now where they only have 2.5 cornerbacks that they trust, with Randall being one, House being the other, and if they're forced to do it, they'll use Hawkins or maybe just give him a series to give one of those guys a break here and there. And then the two slot guys are, again, Morgan Burnett and Jermaine Whitehead. And so, I mean, I guess, what do you think of the potential longevity for that alignment to continue working over the next couple of weeks in what, again, will be must-win games?
I don't think it can. I don't think they can survive a high-level passing game playing that way, because it causes Capers to be conservative. You can't really blitz all that much, because you can't leave Morgan Burnett one-on-one with a wide receiver. It's just the worst possible situation they could be in. You know, I know they played with him in the slot last year and did some good things with it, but they just don't have enough corners right now to get through this. And so, you know, there was at times when they went to the dime last year, I believe they were able to bring in a corner and then have Burnett also on the field. And, you know, that gives you options in terms of if you know, Burnett is forced to line up outside, you know, you can move this other corner outside and him inside. So either way, it's really kind of limited, I think, Capers, how much he can do with his blitz packages, because you got to give Burnett help. And, you know, they even gave Randall help. It wasn't all, I mean, even though he's in man-to-man, there was still help over the top quite a bit. And as they face these receivers, you know, now Devin Funchess, I don't know what they'll do next week there. But, you know, Minnesota has two good receivers. Detroit has already trashed their secondary. So I really don't know what he's going to do in the coming weeks.
Yeah, you know, the missing piece that you mentioned, I think probably from last year, was Micah Hyde, because Hyde would be the guy that was in there, and then they could play Burnett in the dime, and Kentrell Bryce used to come onto the field as the extra safety next to Clinton Dix. You know, Burnett is a guy that I think the coaches, I mean, I don't think, I know the coaches love what he brings in terms of intelligence, accountability. He's not going to make mistakes. He knows the defense. He can call the defense. But I don't know what measurement to put on it, whether it's half a step or a step, but he looks slower to me than he was last season. And I don't know if all of the muscle injuries that he's had, whether it's groin or hamstring, this season and last season have started to catch up with him, or maybe it's just because he's played so, you know, he's played 7-8 years in the league now. But do you see speed diminishing slightly there for him?
Well, I see him having to cover wide receivers more, and that's, to me, that pretty much spotlights his lack of speed. You know, he can't match with those guys. A lot of times, you know, last year or when they were playing him in the Nitro defense, he could match up with a tight end, and they didn't need him as much in the slot. Now he's matching up with wide receivers, and that's a hard thing to do. Even if you're playing zone, it's hard for a safety. He's just, it's not the same as playing a quick guy like Hawkins or Randall. And I think what you're really seeing now is their failure to sign somebody during the season. They probably should have signed some kind of veteran. Even once, you know, King's shoulder started acting up, I think they needed to have found somebody who at least has some experience and could play in the slot a little bit. And, you know, you'd have to do it with protection over the top. You need a corner, and they're not playing their undrafted rookies. So I don't know. I don't know how you win with one quarterback on the field.
Well, do you think Ted could convince Carolina to cut Ladarius Gunter before Sunday?
Yeah. I don't think so right now.
I don't think so either.
After next week, but no, you know, that's, you hate to say it. I mean, I don't know if they miss Ladarius Gunter, but they miss somebody who knows how to play corner.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. I agree with you. So shifting from offense to defense a little bit, you know, there was the point in time where the Packers were down 21-7. Things were not looking very good. It was late in the third quarter and even early into the fourth where they were down two scores. And what was it that you saw that really started to turn the game around for Brett Hundley and the offense?
Well, essentially, so Greg Williams had a very good game plan against the Packers. He started out stopping the run. He knew the Packers were going to start out trying to run the ball. And I thought he played to that and tried to stop the run. And then once they got ahead, he just blitzed the heck out of Hundley. I mean, it seemed like they were blitzing every single down. Now, the downside to that for him was that he had his corners play soft
right
off of that. He didn't want to get beat deep by Adams or Cobb, or Nelson. So McCarthy just had Hundley, you know, throw the quick hitches and go 6-8 yards at a time and go in no huddle. And it was good. It was a good adjustment. It took a while, but it was a very good adjustment against that defense. And they just kept chipping away. And finally, you know, they get a run by Jamal Williams. And ultimately, it really helped them move the ball. It was pretty effective.
No, and I think the statistics really explain exactly what you just said. Looking at the receiving numbers for the Packers, they had, let's see, they had 6 different guys catch passes, and the longest average gain for all those guys is 9.9 for Jamal Williams, and that's counting the 30-yard touchdown. Davante Adams, 8.4 yards a catch. Randall Cobb, 4.9. Jordy Nelson, 8.3. So this tells you right there, the length of passes is extremely, extremely short. I mean, Davante had 10 catches for 84 yards. 10 catches for 84.
Yeah. They, you know, if they were going to leave that open, if Cleveland was going to give them that throw, that's what they were going to take. And, you know, all they had to do was block that blitz for a 3-step drop and then get rid of it. And all Hundley had to do was not turn it over, not throw an interception. And, you know, Cleveland's playing the odds there that, and every defensive coordinator plays it this way, if you can make a team go 10, 11 plays, you're counting on them making a mistake somewhere along the line. And Hundley was pretty solid from that standpoint. Not great, but, you know, their receivers got some tough yards, and it was enough.
Now, in addition to the big play that Clay Matthews, Demaryius Randle, and Josh Jones made, the one in overtime, the other big field-flipping play was the extremely, extremely important punt return by Trevor Davis. It was, 65 yards? Yeah, 65-yard return, and it was one where he caught the ball sort of in the middle, left center of the field, ran to his left, cut back to his right, went back to his left again, turned the corner and got upfield, and for what felt like the first time all season, the Packers did not have a penalty on a lengthy return. So I guess, first of all, do you agree at this point that Trevor Davis is a legitimate weapon that teams are starting to at least have a little concern about? And second of all, I mean, what do you think went differently that there was no penalty on that play for once?
Well, that was probably the single most impressive play that I've seen this year from the Packers. I mean, just from a pure effort standpoint, it was remarkable because he broke some tackles. He like you said, he changed directions. He used his blocks once he got into the open field. He got extra yards on it at the end, kind of ran past, you know, usually the kicker gets you. You know, oftentimes you see that. He got through the kicker, and it was really impressive. Now, he's still shaky because, you know, he failed to catch that punt that rolled all the way down to the 3-yard line. That was a really big mistake.
Yes, it was.
He needed to run up and catch that ball. And, you know, but he is a threat because of his speed. And so I don't know that teams are going to kick away from him, but they do have to be aware of him at least. And as far as the, you know, the penalties, you could see that they must have worked on it this week, because I saw Joe Thomas had a block that was very close to being a block in the back, and then he raised his arms and he did not touch the guy. And so, you know, they must have really stressed it this week, and for some reason they finally took it to heart. But they definitely made an effort not to block in the back.
And sticking with special teams, I think that, you know, from the very beginning you could see that Mike McCarthy wanted to be aggressive and understood. I mean, of course he understood, but just was able to really put into action the importance of this game. From the very first drive, they dial up the fake punt on the direct snap to Jermaine Whitehead, who had a really nice stiff arm on the defender on the corner to be able to make sure he picked up that yardage. And then later in the drive, they go for it on fourth down again. But first of all, you know, that fake. You've covered the team a lot of years. You know, have you seen the direct snap to the up man a number of times over the years? I know I haven't seen it in my three.
Yeah, I've seen it before. It's a classic fake, and it's a good fake to do early, because generally that's when nobody's expecting a fake on the first series. And of course, something has to be there. They have to line up a certain way, because the way Zook designs it, they only run it if, you know, they run it, they design the play based on how Cleveland typically rushes the punter, and they got what they saw and ran it. This was part of my story as well today, was that, you know, with McCarthy, you never know when he's going to be aggressive and when he's not. And it's really hard to read exactly when he's going to do that. And in that case, it was a really good move. I mean, thanks to Whitehead's stiff arm, it was a good move. But, you know, if he gets tackled there, then it's a whole different story.
And to me, I don't want to say odd, but just interesting that Whitehead was the one in that position, because if you think about that personal protector spot, the Packers have gone through a number of guys at that position this year alone. I mean, I've seen Marwin Evans there. I've seen Kentrell Bryce there. I've seen Ty Montgomery there. And I think I've even seen Josh Jones there at times. So I don't know if Whitehead has really sort of shot off the charts in terms of his performance in practice that we don't see with the team reps. But it's very clear that they're trusting him in a key part of the season, you know, partly out of necessity on defense like we talked about. But I don't think they would put him in that spot when they could have used Marwin Evans or somebody. I mean, they even could have used a running back if they wanted.
Yeah. I mean, he's got the speed to get around the corner. As Morgan Burnett said, he obviously must have carried the ball somewhere during his career, because you don't develop a stiff arm without having some experience running the ball. It's good. You really don't want to put a running back there, because it generally tips off the fact that you might be running it, you know, or at least puts the kick team on alert. I'm sure they had no idea that Jermaine Whitehead had the ability to run with the ball. So that's part of the fake as well. And it worked out.
One thing that I wondered, and you might know the answer to this, but when the Packers decide to run a fake, is it a situation where McCarthy says to Ron Zook, the special teams coordinator, okay, we're going to run a fake, and then Zook picks the fake, or does McCarthy pick the fake too?
I think that's all decided ahead of time. You know, Zook tells him, okay, these are the fake possibilities. If we get this look, or we're likely to get this look, and I like this fake play, you know, I think McCarthy has a script of plays that Zook presents him based on how the other team plays. And McCarthy has it there on his call sheet. And when he wants to go to it, if he feels the need to, you know, go for a fake, then they call that play. That's my understanding of how it works.
One of the big topics that I saw on Twitter throughout the game was this idea or this notion that Rodgers had a significant influence on the offense throughout the game. And I know that we had different vantage points, since I'm still rehabbing my knee here and you were out in Cleveland. But I will say this, the television copy, which is the same one that everybody else saw, they showed Rodgers time after time after time in the second half, and he was more involved and more animated on offense than I've ever seen. I mean, there were times where it looked like him and McCarthy were discussing which plays to call between the two of them, and Rodgers was pointing at certain things, and then on the sideline he was all really into it. Did you catch any of that from the press box, or was any of that discussed after the game?
You know, the only thing, some people in the blog mentioned it, and then the only thing I saw was on the touchdown at the end of the regulation. Rodgers was giving him instruction on what the options were. So, in other words, it was a run-pass option. And if Hundley handed the ball off and they didn't get the touchdown, the call was to spike the ball. And now I didn't know this until after the game, and then I saw the replay of Rodgers, and you could see Rodgers motioning about the spike. So he was definitely in Hundley's ear, and you know, that's probably a sign that he's really engaged because he's going to play.
That's how I took it too.
Yeah, I mean, I think he's ready and raring to go. I have no idea what, you know, the situation is with his shoulder, but the way all this is playing out, it seems like it's a given that he's coming back this week. So I don't know when they'll announce it, if they'll wait till the end of the week, but they're smart. They just announce it tomorrow. And, you know, it builds a lot of, just energy in their locker room, I think, if they do it.
So let's talk about Hundley for a minute now, because, you know, barring injury, there is a very real possibility. I'm not saying it's the most likely one, but there's a possibility that he might have played his last regular season snap for the Green Bay Packers. If they find someone that's interested in him in a trade value, which I think is probably unlikely, or if they decide that that's not what they want to do with the backup quarterback position going into next season, which would be the last year on Hundley's rookie contract. So with 8 games under his belt, a 3-5 record, I think that he's shown that he can play well in big moments. I think that he's shown in other moments that he's very up and down. So what do you sort of make of the 8-week Brett Hundley experience?
Well, I still think that as a starter, he's completely unproven. And if you were to trade for him based on what you've seen over this 8 weeks, I think you need to have your head examined. At least if you were going to give up a mid to high pick, I don't think the Packers trade him. I think he's their backup next season, and they continue to develop another quarterback to be their next backup, and they get the most out of Hundley that they can. And I don't see a team, I don't see John Dorsey running out and giving him a first-round pick for Brett Hundley. I thought Deshaun Kizer showed a lot more than Hundley did. I mean, his arm is really good.
Yeah, it is.
Made some really nice throws, and he's in his first year. So he made the boneheaded play at the end, but, you know, actually, if you look at that play, he's got a guy wide open down the field, and if he hits it, it's a touchdown. So his decision-making, you know, the end result was flawed, but what he saw, if he's able to get rid of that, if Matthews doesn't get his arm, the game's probably over. So I liked Kizer. Watching him, I thought, man, this guy's got some potential. Watching Hundley, I kept thinking, well, this is pretty much the same that he's been all year. He to me, he hasn't improved immensely. He just doesn't make a lot of big plays. Now, they, you know, in the fourth quarter, they had some nice drives, but you can't get away playing that kind of football the whole time, you know, a whole game. And I just haven't seen enough.
You know, you and I have been on the same page with Hundley really dating back to OTAs and training camp, and that's why when you go back and watch the broadcast, and obviously I've already seen it, I was shocked at the commentary from, you know, the two guys in the booth, because they were just, I don't know who they spoke to or if they were instructed or asked to be nice to Hundley, but they were talking about how he has a real future in the league and how he's improved so much and how the things that he's showing now he couldn't have possibly shown 8 weeks ago. And I'm just thinking to myself, holy cow, what is going on? Because I agree with you. I don't see him as a viable starting quarterback in this league yet. And I don't think there was a whole lot of improvement from beginning to end. I mean, certainly there's going to be some, but I agree with you. I think he's still unproven, and we'll have to see how that carries over into next season. Real quickly, before we wrap up here, let's talk about the playoff picture a little bit. There was a couple things that are noteworthy from the action on Sunday. First is that the Philadelphia Eagles may have lost their quarterback, with Carson Wentz reportedly tearing his ACL. in the loss, excuse me, in the victory rather, they had over the Rams. So you never know how that could shake things out in terms of once the playoffs get underway, how much is Philadelphia going to actually be able to do? And then the second big piece of information is that Seattle lost a shocking game to the Jaguars, and they have dropped out of the playoff picture right now, and Atlanta now has the sixth seed. So looking at everything, considering everything, and assuming Rodgers plays in Carolina, do you think it's likely, unlikely, or somewhere else that they make the playoffs this year?
I still think it's unlikely. This game in Carolina is going to be really tough. I don't know how they win that game. I do think, you know, Rodgers, let's assume that Rodgers is going to play. He can make something happen with that offense. They can go back to, you know, what they were. Then they've got the two running backs that are really helped this offense. Jamal Williams had just a phenomenal game. And, you know, I wrote about Aaron Jones being the guy they need to highlight, and I was completely wrong. I mean, Jamal Williams just continues to be productive and give them the kind of hard-nosed running back that you really want around this time of the year. So they have a lot of things going for them offensively, but defensively, I just can't see them holding up. I mean, is Rodgers going to have to throw for 40 points? And I don't know if he can do that in his first game back. Carolina apparently must have looked good if they beat Minnesota at home. Of course, I didn't see the game, and I'm curious to watch it, but that's a big win for them.
Absolutely.
I don't know how the Packers beat them down there.
That, to me, that's another thing, too, is that the wins that the Packers have gotten under Hundley have been against Mitch Trubisky, Jameis Winston in his first game back, and DeShone Kizer. And the quarterbacks they're going to face down the stretch in order are Cam Newton, Case Keenum, and who am I blanking on here?
Matthew
Stafford, right, who've played through the hand injury. And so, obviously, Keenum is not a top-tier quarterback, but the other two guys are certainly established veteran guys that can take advantage of a secondary and a pass rush that essentially has gone missing the last couple of games. And I don't know. I mean, the one thing that the Packers have going for them is that the three teams in the playoffs right now from the NFC North, excuse me, the NFC South, all have to play each other. So they're going to beat up on each other, and barring ties, there's going to be some losses there that could help them. And of course, they have the tiebreak over Seattle from that game early in the season. But I kind of agree with you. I think they might end up on the outside looking in, simply because I think they probably go 2-1 down the stretch. I just don't see them going 3-0.
Yeah, if they go 3-0, then their competition is Seattle. Seattle and Atlanta. And, you know, they have to, of course, they have to finish ahead of Atlanta, or they lose that tiebreaker, unless, you know, what could happen is if Atlanta and Carolina were to tie and Green Bay beats Carolina,
if the Falcons win out, they win their division.
Right. If Carolina and Atlanta tie, but Carolina wins the tiebreaker, then the Packers would make it over, because you first eliminate one team, a tie in the division. So if Atlanta and Carolina tie, and Carolina has a tiebreaker, then Atlanta's out. Then you match Carolina against Green Bay, and since Green Bay would have the head-to-head victory, then they would go in. That's one scenario, but I don't know. I just think pretty much their competition is Seattle and Atlanta.
So do you think that there's any chance that Minnesota is in a position in 2 weeks where they don't play anyone because Philadelphia has already locked up the one seed?
It's possible. Losing today was probably a bad blow. Well, it was a bad blow for the Packers in several ways. One, they needed Carolina to lose, and two, yeah, they would like to have Minnesota cruising into the playoffs by week 16. I don't know that Minnesota would cruise, but if they were already eliminated from home field advantage, yeah, I could see them, you know, maybe resting guys eventually. But I don't think that's going to happen. I think they're still in the running for home field, and they're going to bring it second to last game.
So that's a lot to keep in mind and a lot of different scenarios that could play out in the coming weeks. Is there anything else you want to touch on from the Cleveland game before we wrap this one up?
Only it was really, really bizarre to go to a stadium that was like half full. There were so many empty seats. It was unbelievable. And there were a lot of Packer fans there who bought their tickets before Rodgers got hurt. And it was like almost, I mean, not playing a game in quiet, but it was pretty different. I'm not sure I've seen an experience like that.
Of the people that did go, what percentage would you say were actually Browns fans?
I would say it was probably 30 to 35% Packer fans, and the rest Browns. It's kind of hard to tell because so many of those seats were orange.
Yeah, and, that's true.
They all blend in, but there were still more Browns fans. But as the Packers started to rally, then, you know, you could see the crowd shift a little bit.
So the Packers will be on the road again next week in Carolina for what could be the return of Aaron Rodgers. We'll have plenty of coverage leading up to that game and through next weekend on jsonline.com and packersnews.com. How was the live blog?
Oh, it went great. Man, did we have good attendance. I think it might have been one of the highest of the entire season.
Really? How high was it?
I know that we had, well, it'll continue to grow. It does. People go back and look at it. But we had over almost 17,000 unique visitors. And then it was closing in. It was over 40,000 page hits. So
wow.
That was, I think there was the only game above that was, what was it, Pittsburgh, I think was the highest so far this year.
And I imagine there might be a lot of attendance next week if number 12 is playing quarterback for the Packers.
Yeah, I would think so. Yeah.
All right. So thank you very much for tuning into this episode of the Packers Podcast. For Tom, my name is Michael Cohen, and we will talk to you guys soon.